Pod Save the World is brought to you by Incogni. Have you ever wondered how a random company you've never heard of got your personal cell phone number? It's because data brokers are constantly collecting and selling our details behind the scenes. It's invasive, and honestly, it's an exhausting thing to manage. While you have the legal right to opt out, the process is intentionally designed to be a bureaucratic nightmare. That's why I'm a fan of Incogni. Instead of spending dozens of hours chasing down these companies, Incogni acts as your personal privacy advocate. They handle the requests to get your info deleted so you don't have to. Once you create an account and give them permission, Incogni automatically reaches out to data brokers on your behalf and demands they remove your data. What's even better is that Incogni doesn't just do this once. They continually monitor these sites and make sure your info stays off the market. And for those seeking total control, their unlimited plan features custom data removals. If you can see your info somewhere it shouldn't be, just send Incogni the link and their team of actual humans will step in to take it down for you. There are a ton of data brokers out there these days. They're all selling some of our data. Some of it's very personal. Some of it's can be used to try to hack you. Some of it can be used to try to scam you. You really want to use a company like Incogni to get your personal information off the internet and just do a cleanup of what's out there. Take your personal data back with Incogni. It's even independently verified by Deloitte, so you know they're the real deal. Go to incogni.com/PSTW and use the code PSTW to get 60% off an annual plan. That's code PSTW at incogni.com/PSTW for 60% off. Plus, try it risk-free for 30 days with their money-back guarantee. Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, I'm sad to say, the Knicks lost yesterday. Donald Trump was at the game last night. Here's what it sounded like when they showed his beautiful, soon-to-be-asleep face on the Jumbotron at MSG. Let's watch. Ben, how responsible is Donnie T for the Knicks' loss? And how glad is Zoran that no one is blaming him because he was also there? No one's saying, hey, Zoran, you jinxed them.
So first of all, the best thing about that is that they clearly intentionally showed Trump during the national anthem, thinking that New Yorkers might not be doing that.
Give me a break. Of course they will.
Do you not understand New Yorkers, like the person running that Jumbotron? He's 50% or probably 60% responsible. Okay. The referees are 40% responsible. Okay. Like, there's a lot of bitterness in Knick world today about the foul discrepancy, the Wemby takedown of Jalen Brunson. But yeah, I mean, we had the most incredible karma going. We ripped off like 13 wins in a row. And then Trump has to insert himself and ruin nice things. And that's what happened.
Not great. By the way, also at the game last night was our former boss, Rahm Emanuel. I don't know if you saw him sitting on the wood. Right? He was courtside with like his brother. It was Larry David. It was Patriots owner Bob Kraft. I talked to Rahm for a bit this morning. He was like, what you don't get watching it on TV is like just how violent the game is. These are like the biggest people you've ever seen in your life crashing into each other at full speed. And we would just snap in half because we're little babies.
I got to sit down there once, up close where you can really see it. And like every time Carl Anthony Towns hit the ground, I didn't know how he was going to get up again.
Yeah.
These guys are so big and they're just like flying around. I missed the garden though, man. I went so much when I was a kid and there's no electricity like that anywhere else I've been in life.
You got to befriend like Stiller and Timothy Chalamet and see if you can get one of those seats in between them. Ben, did you notice that during TV timeouts, Larry David was reading a book? I think it was called All We Say. It's by this guy named Ben Rhodes. It's newly minted, part of the New York Times bestseller list that I think you can pick up right now. Larry David must have snagged one on the way in from the bestseller list.
Yeah, we made number 5, Worldos, and that's all because of you. So I really appreciate it. And, it's right up Larry David. It's Ali, I'm sure. I have to say to Tommy, like, it's wonderful to be doing these events. At every event, like, a good chunk of the crowd is just Worldos.
It's awesome.
And you get this like glimpse. I think I told you my favorite one was a guy came up to me and said he's a postal carrier and he listens to us on his route.
That's awesome.
How awesome is that? You know,
I love that.
Love you guys coming out. I do have this ongoing never ending tour, which is why I'm always remote. I will be tonight, Wednesday, in San Francisco at the Corte Madero Book Passage, which seems exciting. And a whole bunch of stuff next week too, which I'll update people on. But thanks for picking up the book. Pick up some more copies. We've got David Sedaris in the sight lines at the top of that list.
Okay.
I'm not sure I'm catching up to him, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, go buy a book, go see Ben, buy them for your friends, buy them for your enemies. For now, we have a great show for you guys. We're going to tell you about the clashes between Iran and Israel over the weekend. There's reports, Ben, this morning that Iran shot down a U.S. helicopter and Trump has pledged to respond. We can talk about that. We'll talk about how Trump and Netanyahu are managing all of this. Well, to me, I think just quietly hating each other and getting sick of each other and wishing this couple's trip was over. Then we're going to tell you about...
They deserve each other.
They really
do. Two men who deserve each other.
They really do. And the new Supreme Leader. They're going to tell you about this. We'll tell you about this controversial real estate deal that is being pursued by Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump that has led to allegations of corruption and explosive protests across Albania. We're going to tell you what to expect from the FIFA World Cup tournament. It's bigger, more expensive than ever before. We'll talk about all the ways that Trump is using the games to piss off half the world, mostly Africa, and then get PR for himself. Chinese President Xi Jinping is visiting a surprisingly economic resilient North Korea this week. I think his trip is wrapping up sort of as we record this. We'll tell you why. We'll also talk about former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton plea deal over his mishandling of classified information. There's a story of this unbelievable story, really, of the senior CIA officer who was caught with a bunch of gold bars in his house. We love a gold bar story here. And then there's just an amazing fake it till you make it story out of Nigeria that I just couldn't resist playing for you at the very end. And then, Ben, at the end, you're going to hear my conversation with the BBC's Will Grant. He was just back from Cuba. We talked about what life is like on the ground for the Cuban people since Trump has cut off fuel supplies to the island. We'll talk about like what a soft U.S. regime change operation might look like, what a military operation might look like, who the Cuban people blame for the situation, and much, much more. So a really, really interesting conversation with Will.
He's a great guy. I used to talk to Will a lot when I was working on Cuba, because he's one of those journalists that I would learn more from him than he would probably learn from me. I love journalists like that.
Yes. He just got back and now he's in Mexico City. So we also talked a little bit about the World Cup and how it's playing down there because the World Cup is in three countries this time. And also, Ben, just flagging for everybody that we have some amazing video clips this episode. So subscribe to Podsafe World on YouTube so you don't miss any of it. Also, you help us grow the show and get good information to people. And also, if you love the show, if you love Crooked Media, if you want ad-free episodes, if you want bonus episodes of Podsafe America, if you want bonus polling deep dives from Dan Pfeiffer and a lot more, consider becoming a friend of the pod subscriber. Go to crooked.com/friends. You'll learn more. It's about $10 a month. And you know, if you want to help progressive independent media, it's the single most helpful thing you can do to help us grow as an organization and continue to dominate Ben Shapiro and the Daily Wire and help me clap back at Meghan McCain when she yells at me over made up vote fraud allegations in LA here.
I saw that. You've been particularly active online.
I was very bored.
I
was on a plane.
I tweeted like 8 times about the referees last night. And then I like was like, what am I doing with myself? This is not healthy.
I actually think that's a much healthier use of Twitter than whatever the hell I was doing.
Then Meghan McCain. Yeah, that's
true. That was just dumb.
Meghan McCain calling you a pod bro and stuff.
Whatever. She's like tweeting disinformation. I'm like, hey, maybe this is fake and you shouldn't spread it. You should just like Google the actual facts, and she gets all mad and whatever. Anyway.
Maybe the people of Los Angeles don't like Spencer Pratt. You know, that's not a huge shock.
The MAGAs who like, look, we live in LA. Like we have a sense of what the electorate cares about here. 15% of the county, I think, or the city is registered Republican. It was unlikely that he was ever going to do well when he was like closing, going on Gutfeld and Fox and Friends with like a crazy MAGA message, but such is life. So Ben, it was another head spinning week in the war in Iran. Let me just walk you through some of the timeline. So Wednesday of last week, so week before this came out, Israel and Lebanon announced a ceasefire in Lebanon. Then a day later, we learned that Hezbollah is not on board with the ceasefire deal, which is a bit of a problem since they are one of the two parties doing most of the firing. Then over the weekend, the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, said they hit about 150 Hezbollah sites in southern Lebanon. So Hezbollah fired rockets into northern Israel. The IDF then responded with strikes into southern Beirut, and we are off to the races. And remember, last week, Trump told us that he had gotten Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, to be restrained and stop hitting targets in Beirut, and then Netanyahu goes and does exactly that. So that's when the wheels like fully come off the ceasefire bus, and Iran fired around 30 missiles directly to Israel. And then on Monday, the Houthi rebels even got in the game, and they fired a missile at Israel and threatened to attack ships in the Red Sea affiliated with Israel. And so for a while there, you know, Sunday night, Monday morning, it felt like we were on the cusp of returning to full-scale warfare, and that Netanyahu was going to authorize some like massive retaliation on Iran. But Trump seems to have called him to try to chill things out. And we know this because first Trump called Axios in the Financial Times and a bunch of other news outlets to let them know that Bibi was, in fact, his bitch and that the U.S. called all the shots. That's almost a direct quote. And so ultimately, the Israeli response was relatively restrained. They hit like a petrochemical plant, some other infrastructure. But both sides are sort of standing down for now. But Ben, I did think this was a remarkable and a very important moment and inflection point, because it just shows, again, like we can bump along, the stock markets can ignore what's happening, the oil markets can fluctuate, but like the war is not close to over. And then big picture, I think this shows that Iran is not at all deterred. In fact, they are emboldened, right? And they've directly linked the fighting with Hezbollah to the conflict between the U.S. and Israel and Iran in a way that is not going to make Netanyahu very happy. So just curious what you made of these events, and in particular, the Iranians deciding to just launch a massive ballistic missile barrage into Israel once again.
I think that the thruple of Netanyahu, Trump, and the new supreme leader is not exactly designed to de-escalate circumstances. Because if you look at the three parties, you know, we've talked a lot about what the deal would be. Everybody knows what the deal would be, right? You know, straight for blockade, for revenue, for some nuclear concessions, for more revenue for Iran. Israel does not want that deal. Even if they're kind of forced to accept that they can't keep bombing Iran, they'll escalate in Lebanon because Hezbollah is never going to accept an outcome in which they totally disarm. And that's Israel's pretext to occupy southern Lebanon and do as much damage as they can. So Israel is not exactly, you know, looking for or interested in a peace deal. Trump is trying to save face and present whatever happens as a victory, but that's just not possible because he's not meeting his objectives and the Iranians aren't capitulating at the negotiating table. And so he kind of stays on the precipice of getting drawn back into things. But importantly, he doesn't want to get drawn all the way back into like the kind of full-blown war that we were in earlier this spring, which the Iranians know, which brings you the Iranians, which is they don't feel like people that are desperate for a deal either. I think they want to appear to have really bloodied the nose of the United States and Israel to establish deterrence so that the United States doesn't launch another war. They recognize how isolated Israel is internationally. And so, you know, if Israel's doing things in Lebanon, they kind of want to spotlight that by launching their own attacks. And so even though the only way the war ends is for all three parties to just kind of accept that none of them are going to achieve all of their aims here, I think the leadership of the three countries, the supreme leader and the IRGC and Iran, Trump and Netanyahu, just kind of can't seem to bring themselves to say yes. And maybe the only thing that will get them there is if the global economy really does just start imploding and it's unsustainable.
Yeah, that does seem like that would be maybe the only thing that gets everybody just to take some tough steps politically. I mean, it was remarkable. Tuesday morning, we learned that Iran shot down a U.S. Apache helicopter patrolling the Strait of Hormuz. There was, you know, the Pentagon, I think, told some journalists that they believe it was Iranian drone, but they weren't sure that it was on purpose. Which is like, what? Like, first of all, what the fuck are you talking about? Of course it was on purpose. And one of those things that, you know, if that had happened during the Obama administration, we would have been accused of like the most pathetic capitulation in history, right? And then I saw just before we started recording that Trump called the Wall Street Journal and said that the helicopter incident, quote, wasn't a big deal and that the pilot was fine. So this is an Apache helicopter that was shot out of the sky. The crew spent hours in the water, like in the dark. They were only rescued by some sort of like unmanned drone system that happened to find them. But all of a sudden, that's no big deal. Like, look, I don't want us to resume full-scale warfare, right? Like, this is what sucks about being a Democrat and being responsible, because Republicans would just rightly call that statement out for being unbelievably weak and feckless and pathetic. But that's what it is.
Well, I remember you could pick any event. Do you remember when like some US sailors got
they veered off into the wrong waters, right?
They veered off in the wrong waters and pretty briefly they were held by Iran, but then they were released.
John Kerry called them and they heard about that, right? Yeah.
John Kerry literally called the foreign minister and they let him go. But we heard about that incident for the rest of the Obama presidency. Yep. And like Trump and Ted Cruz were like making it part of their like stump speeches in the campaign. So there's absolutely no obviously consistency with these guys. I think like the two things that stand out from that incident are the Iranians are pretty determined, however this war ends, to kind of leave the distinct impression that they have the capacity to control that strait. So even if they reopen it, the subtext is we can close it again. And so that's, where they're focusing, their military efforts, and pretty brazen and, to shoot down a U.S. helicopter like that.
Yeah. So much for Pete Hegseth telling us that, that we'd taken out all their military capacity, right? That those briefings feel like a long time ago.
Oh yeah. We destroyed their Navy and their missiles. Yeah. But we talked about this, but they're just so full of lies and they don't get called out because Iran's military capability is, clearly just fine, unfortunately. And look, the reality is that Trump doesn't want to get all the way back into this thing. Like he sees the writing on the wall with the markets. That's why he's so frantically calling Axios to talk or having Witkoff call them or Jared to say there's a deal every Friday before the markets close. And frankly, he can pretend like he doesn't care, but I'm sure that Trump is aware of like Tucker Carlson and Megyn Kelly and some of these other people. Like he's losing his base. He's already lost independence. And so I think he knows that if he goes all back into war, he could really crater even more than he already has. That gives the Iranians a lot of leverage, frankly.
And just as we're recording this, CENTCOM put out a statement that they've begun some sort of self-defense strikes against Iran. We don't know exactly what it is, but they said it's in response to the downing of the Apache helicopter. So they're saying it's proportional in response to whatever Iran did. Who knows? But I mean, look, that they can try to be measured and try to keep it proportional, but like the cycle of violence continues. There is no ceasefire. Trump was saying earlier that there could be a deal done in 2 to 3 days. Ben, CNN counted up the number of times Trump has said we're close to a peace deal or that Iran is desperate for a peace deal. You want to guess how many they found?
I'm going to guess 8.
38.
Oh, my 38 God.
38 times.
Oh, my God.
So it's going good.
I have to go back through Barak Ravid's Twitter feed. I mean, look, we're in this kind of state of like it's a semi-frozen conflict with these episodic outbursts of violence and more sustained violence in Lebanon. And that's, one of these times the stop clock will be right because the only way this thing ends is in a deal. So nobody's going to surrender here.
Or the Iranians. I mean, look, they drone shot down an Apache helicopter. I mean, thank God that the American pilots weren't killed, but eventually some will be, and that will lead to the escalation ladder going up. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that may happen. And then that, what that does to public opinion in this country too, I think we'll be leading more in the direction of let's get the hell out of there than in the direction of like, let's just dive back in.
Yeah. Another victim of this war, Ben, has been the English language. Here's President Trump kind of explaining the problem to us. Let's watch.
How do you define ceasefire?
Pretty much the way it is. It's a different part of the world. You know, I'd say in that part of the world, ceasefire is when you're shooting in a more moderate manner.
They put up a blockade, and so we blockaded them, and we have the ultimate blockade. I don't consider that a war, but if you want to define it as such, I guess you can.
Well, how do you define it?
I don't define it at all. I don't think about it. I just do what I have to do.
During your 2016 campaign, you called the Middle East a quagmire. What makes you so sure this won't become a quagmire?
We're not going to be there.
You're convinced this won't become a quagmire?
It's not a quagmire. The official name is highly enriched uranium. And I call it nuclear dust because it seemed to be nice and everyone understands it better and it's sort of cute and people picked it up.
So, Ben, I honestly laughed at Trump's definition of a ceasefire because he's kind of like accurately capturing the absurdity of the way the term is being used. But just, my advice to every reporter is like, just stop letting this man redefine words. Like there is a dictionary definition for a reason. A ceasefire means that everyone has stopped shooting. A blockade is an act of war. The Middle East is a quagmire, has been for the U.S. The U.S. is 100% still at war, no matter what Trump says is happening right now. So is Israel. And the highly enriched uranium, it's not dust, it's uranium. It's like, we don't have to repeat this bullshit spin. It's embarrassing for everybody.
Well, this is an original sin in the media, which is that they kind of repeated, Trump says he ended 8 wars. Like nobody pointed out that like he didn't end any of them. And some of them are ongoing. Some of them ended a long time ago, right? The ceasefires are not fragile. They don't exist, so there is an absurdity to this, but it matters to your point because it kind of creates this veneer that things aren't happening that are happening. I mean, for instance, how much does it cost the United States taxpayer to sustain this massive military blockade of Iran and all these other forward deployments and all these missile defense systems we move there. Like, by acting like there's a ceasefire, you're ignoring the fact that not only is there ongoing violence, not only is there an ongoing war, but we're spending billions and billions of dollars doing it. And so that's why it's so important to be factual about this, because there's a deliberate effort by people like Trump to misinform you. Like, don't look over here. There's a ceasefire. You know, there are talks. There's almost a deal. Like, when none of those things are happening.
The prime minister of Lebanon says Israel has carried out 3,500 airstrikes since April 16th, when the so-called ceasefire was agreed to. Yeah, it's not
it's not moderate.
No, yeah. It's not even close.
Yeah. It's just straight up not a ceasefire.
Just nonsense. This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform designed to elevate your online presence and drive your success. Squarespace gives you the tools to claim your domain, build a professional website, expand your brand, and facilitate payments all in one place. With Squarespace's collection of cutting-edge design tools, anyone can build a bespoke online presence that fits perfectly with their business. Start with Blueprint AI, Squarespace's AI-enhanced website builder, to get a fully custom website in just a few steps using basic information about your industry, goals, and personality to generate premium-quality content and personalized design recommendations. Every dream needs a domain. Squarespace Domains makes it easy to find the best name for your business at one fair, all-inclusive price, no hidden fees or add-ons required. Squarespace provides everything you need to bring more of your dream to life. Don't wait to claim your name. Invest in your dream domain today. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/world to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/world. This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. When it comes to sending money abroad, many providers claim to offer free fees and competitive rates. But don't be fooled. This can be code for inflated exchange rates. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies without ever having to worry about hidden fees. Sending pounds across the pond, most transfers arrive in 20 seconds or less. Spending reals in Rio, the Wise card gives you the mid-market rate on every purchase, no costly markups on your bill. Getting paid in dollars for your side gig, avoid hidden fees, and get the real exchange rate every time. With 24/7 access to live support, your international transactions with Wise are quick, transparent, and safe. Plus, Wise runs over 7 million daily checks to catch and prevent fraud. 15 million people already trust Wise to manage their money internationally. Be smart, get Wise. I've used Wise before. It's a great way to send, spend, and get money in tons of different currencies, especially when you're traveling abroad. You can just sort of use it to pay for stuff. You can use it to get cash.
Yen.
You always get, there you go. That's a currency. You always get the best rate. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. All right, Ben, let's check in on America's most corrupt couple, Jared and Ivanka Trump. Here is Ivanka on one of those podcasts that I think just does like softball interviews with various business founders. Let's watch.
I'm working on an incredible project with my husband in the Mediterranean. It's massive in scale, an unbelievable, beautiful 1,400-hectare private island in the middle of the Mediterranean. We were on a friend's boat and we stopped for a swim. Effectively, that's how we found it. We swam to the islands. We went on a hike barefoot all the way up to the top, and we were just captivated. For me, it feels more like a challenge than anything else. A lot of reflection on how I want to live, how I think people increasingly are wanting to live, and trying to really build something that's a tangible manifestation of that.
Okay, so Ivanka is talking about a little island called Sazan. She's a colonizer dressed like a Pepto-Bismol. It's called Sazan. It's in the Adriatic Sea. It's off the coast of Albania. The history is interesting. The Soviets had a submarine base on the island until the 1950s. It's apparently still filled with Cold War era bunkers and tunnels and stuff and fortifications. The island was closed off to people until 2015, until it was opened for some limited tourism. Largely because the broader area as well, is protected ecological reserve. It's home to hundreds of bird species, in particular flamingos and pelicans, and there's seals and turtles and other wildlife. Sounds beautiful. In 2024, the Albanian government suddenly and suspiciously removed those environmental protections and preliminarily approved tourism development. And everyone in Albania is trying to figure out why, which brings Jared and Ivanka into our story. So, our Christopher Columbus here and Christine Columbus say they discovered this island that is, again, just in the Adriatic Sea that's been, you know, people have lived there for thousands of years. They discovered it when they were putzing around on a yacht owned by a member of the Rothschild family, literally, Ben. Jared told this story on the All In podcast. Like, you just can't make this shit up. So shortly after they discovered this island and they went on their swim and their barefoot walk, Edi Rama, the prime minister of Albania, surprisingly joined Jared and Ivanka on the Rothschild yacht. Fast forward a few years, and Jared is somehow leading this effort to develop a $1.6 billion luxury resort on this island that reportedly has up to 10,000 hotel rooms and villas. Albania's anti-corruption organization is called SPAC. They smell a rat. They're investigating. They're looking at just how this region lost the protected status. And then people in Albania are furious. There have been huge protests since last month when developers put up barbed wire fences to keep people out of the site. And then there's a video of the security guard just beating the shit out of a protester that went super viral. So Ben, here's a clip of an Albanian tour guide named Dejana KJ, who's been protesting. She posted this on her Instagram.
This revolution, it's starting in Albania, but it's going to be worldwide. We are taking our power back, power to the people. We don't need any more resorts. We need more wetlands. We need more oxygen. We need more trees. We can't afford doing that right now. Worldwide. I'm not talking as an Albanian. I'm talking as a human being that loves this world.
So, Ben, I love this protest movement. Obviously, I get why people like leaders in Albania would want more money and investment in tourism. But I think the Albanian people have every right to believe that Jared Kushner greased this deal in a corrupt way by leveraging his ties to the president of the United States. And I would demand that those details be released and to figure out who is profiting, because there's just like, none of this story smells right. I'm sorry, Ivanka, that your little narrative didn't go over so well, but here we are.
This story exemplifies so much of what is completely fucked up about the world. First of all, just think about the fact that the kinds of people that end up on boats or beach Albania are usually migrants, right? It's one of the places that people have gotten stranded. But lo and behold, there's Ivanka on the Rothschild yacht discovering this wonderful private island and then just deciding that she and her husband are going to essentially own it.
They get to own it,
you know? Yeah. And then clearly leveraging, as we've seen time and again with Trump family interests, the power of the United States government. Implicit or explicit, you know, you don't necessarily have to state the threat or something. Albania is a small country. Edi Rama is like, oh, okay, sure, you can have this island. And here's the thing that is so fucked up about this is, yes, first and foremost, there's obviously massive environmental implications. There's like, you know, species on there that'd be wiped out. There's wetlands that would be wiped out. But it's not as if any of the money from this development is going to reach ordinary Albanians. Give me a break. The people going to this are going to be the same kind of rich Epstein class people that like to go to private islands that each other owns. Like, maybe there'll be some menial jobs for Albanians, like cleaning up the hotel rooms. But at the end of the day, this is literally separated from the Albanian economy. It's just an island.
And Edi Rama is saying that directly. He was like talking about the deal, calling it luxury tourist destination. And he was arguing that, well, Albania can make as much money from 400 yachts as we can from 40,000 like non-rich visitors, which is like a tough message when you have this like populist mob uprising opposing this progress. He's like, oh, no, it's only gonna be the worst rich elites. And people are comparing it to Epstein Island, as you said.
And that's not true, right? Because if you're prioritizing that kind of tourism, it creates a lot less jobs than the kind of tourism where people are walking around cities and eating in restaurants and going in taxi cabs. And look, that woman is exactly right. Like, the Albanian people are showing a lot of resilience and a lot of guts and a lot of humor in the way that they're out there protesting. But I think she's not wrong that there's such pent-up frustration with the corruption and inequality and the kind of disgusting privilege of people like Ivanka and Jared that events like this can be triggers that spread across borders. I think this is already like remaking Albanian politics in ways that Edi Rama never anticipated. And I think people are going to continue to mobilize when things like this happen because they're so unbelievably offensive. And the fact that she lacks the self, she's sitting in some room that, I mean, looks like a place that is like alternatively like soft lit podcast or like people could be tortured in there or something. What is that? The white lights, what is going on there?
Yeah, it was very weirdly lit.
Like, she's so divorced. How divorced is that from the lived experience of just some Albanian who's like sitting there wondering like, why the hell we're selling off like big chunks of land to these people.
Yeah. And in like Eddie Rama whined, like, oh, this wasn't Jared Kushner, people wouldn't give a shit about the project. That's a direct quote. But it's like, yeah, man. Like,
well, yeah. Yeah,
people
yeah,
wouldn't be as yeah. mad if they didn't think like the president's son-in-law was trying to, you know, corruptly buy off this island. Also, Rama won a fourth term by promising to get Albania into the EU. But the European Commission has warned that this project could run afoul of some of their environmental rules. So it could upend his entire project. So he's going to have a tough political choice coming up. It is delicious and something we'll continue to watch here. Ben, are you excited about the World Cup? Are you a soccer guy?
I am. I'm actually going to a game.
I think I'm going to go to a game too. I'm going to try my best, but I'll let you guys know how it goes once, if it happens. But
I'm going to a game in Houston next week between Portugal and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Nice.
I think I'm going thanks to like a World O. I heard that there was like a guy that worked at the stadium that heard I was in town for an event. So thank you, World O's.
Damn, look at you.
The DRC is looking good, by the way. Like they're looking like the best team from the African continent.
So. Yeah, well, it's going to be exciting. So the tournament kicks off this week. It's literally the biggest World Cup ever. There's three host countries, the US, Mexico, and Canada. And then there's going to be games in 16 different cities. 48 teams made the tournament this year instead of the usual 32. It will be watched by literally billions of people, and the games themselves will span 39 days. There will be periods where there's like literally four and up times up to six games per day. So buckle up, bosses across the world who are worried about productivity yeah, this yes, month. It is not without controversy. ICE officers are going to be out in force because, you know, that always turns out well, just unleashing them on cities. Check out this clip of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen talking about the ICE presence at the World Cup.
Now, what a lot of people don't think about when they start talking about World Cup is what about the counterfeit products that come in or the human trafficking? When you have crowds this big, criminal activities follow. Well, ICE and HSI are going to be out there every day fighting against the counterfeit tickets, human trafficking, drug smuggling, counterfeit products. They're going to be working hand in hand with CBP along the way. Now, I know there's a lot of acronyms there. So on the bottom of the screen, we're going to tell you what each one of them meant.
Hey, boss, hold this ball. We have no idea what you should do with it. We can tell you feel really uncomfortable. So maybe just like spin it around. I mean, maybe globetrotter it or something like that. You just look like such a weird dork in that picture. Have you never touched a soccer ball before, sir?
And what's the social media strategy behind the like little pops when they put ICE up there? And like, I think, by the way, I think people have a pretty good idea what ICE is.
Yeah.
I don't think we need like the text explanation. I also love like the bizarre like focus on counterfeit. I mean, clearly ICE is there to intimidate people. Like,
yeah, they're not doing counterfeit.
Are we really? I mean, actually, I look forward to buying some counterfeit merch. Like, what are you saying? Like, we have to like have a massive sting operation so that only FIFA can, you know, pad its pockets with like merch? Give me a break. Like, part of American sports is like the guy selling the t-shirt down the street.
That's right. Yeah, FIFA selling $375 host city jerseys that are the ugliest things I've ever seen. Ben, there's also been some other controversies. Like the Iranian team barely got visas for the games, and the U.S. is forcing them to commute to the games in the U.S. from Mexico and force them to stay in Mexico. A bunch of Iranian and African journalists have struggled to get the right visas to cover what's happening. There's a Somali referee named Omar Artan who was denied entry to the U.S. I think in Miami when he'd already flown here, even though he's supposed to be one of FIFA's 52 referees at the World Cup. This guy is literally like the top referee in Africa. I think he was African Referee of the Year last year and was rejected, I think, just because he's a Somali guy. Fans from Iran and Haiti have been denied entry to the U.S. A lot of other fans have been denied visas. And even the people who can make it here are struggling to afford tickets because FIFA jacked up all the prices to the World Cup, which means the games were unaffordable. But it also meant that a bunch of resellers gobbled them up in that moment because they thought they wouldn't, you know, they get sold out and now they're having trouble reselling them. So these games are going to be impossible to afford, but also the stadiums are empty, which is wonderful. But Ben, you look, every World Cup has its issues. People tend to ignore those issues once kickoff starts. I mean, the last one was in Qatar of all places, but it does suck that Trump is going to use this opportunity again, like be a dick to entire continents, be racist to entire groups of people. And then also, you know, that he will somehow find a way to make it all about himself by the very end.
Yeah, the Iran thing is just so petty. I mean, give me a break. Like, let the coach into the country. Like let them stay. This is so stupid. And it makes us look small. And it speaks to the bigger point, which is like, usually when you host something like the World Cup, it's like this opportunity to like showcase your country. Like we're turning it into an opportunity to make the rest of the world loathe us even more than they do, you know?
Right.
And because it's also like the manifestation of all American excess, right? Like the absurdity of the ticket sale and resale industry, right? The like absurd displays of like Trumpian force with ICE, the casual racism towards people from Somalia because what, Trump's still mad about Minneapolis or something. Right.
And like Haiti made the tournament and we're not letting Haitian fans in. That's so shitty. Like Haiti like deserves this one little bright spot.
And again, just because what? Because J.D. Vance told Trump that some Haitians were eating dogs.
Right.
Like he gets these fixations on certain groups of people and he sticks with them. But like my hope is that when the games actually start, like it will just become about the soccer and not any of this nonsense. But like it's going to be like an overhang. We're not making our best impression of people. And part of what like stresses me out about it, Tommy, is having just lived through the Trump performance at the Knicks game. We have the Olympics in LA.
Oh, yeah.
In a couple of years. So this is just a dry run for Trump to ruin an international sporting event.
Yeah, it is. And also FIFA is also terrible. I mean, again, I was talking to Rahm Emanuel this morning. When he was mayor of Chicago, FIFA wanted to host games in Chicago and have them be one of the host cities. And Rahm said no. And he was telling me about why. And it's because the FIFA model lets them claim like the bulk of the ticketing revenue, the broadcasting revenue, sponsorship revenue, concessions, cars, parking. And then the city is supposed to carry the burden for public transportation, safety, security, like medical services, fire protection, and then even like VIP escorts for people that FIFA deemed worthy. And also FIFA demanded that the contract with Chicago include the right to force them to build a dome on Soldier Field for the tune of like $50 to $100 million. And Rahm was like,
yeah, no,
can you take that out? And they're like, no, we won't, but like, just trust us. And then they were also at the time were demanding that FIFA fund like transportation for ticket holders. And then like a big, like free FIFA fan fest, which cities were just on the hook for doing. And a bunch of them had decided they had to cancel because they just couldn't afford it. So it's like, this whole thing, it's like a boondoggle for FIFA. They'll make a ton of money.
Yeah.
Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA, will fluff Trump at every opportunity possible, including, you know, he started when he gave him the FIFA Peace Prize. But I like, it's just not clear that it's going to end well for the host cities, at least not financially.
No. And it's going to call into question whether it's worth hosting these big things. Right. And that it, like, then it'll end up just being in places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, because it's just made to, you have to jump through so many hoops and spend so much money, and you have to treat this guy Infantino like he's some kind of head of state, you know. Like the beautiful game will be what it is, and I'm excited to watch it, you know. Don't let it spoil things, but like, yeah, it is just so indicative of the times that there's this like kind of cloud of politics and corruption and profiteering off of it. I mean, it may be the play, Tommy, is to like wait. Maybe you can get pretty cheap tickets at the last minute because those guys will need to dump the tickets at some point.
I think so. I hope so. I think it'll be fun to be able to just go to random games on a weekday. One last thing, Ben. Our producers wanted us to know that they have diligently scanned the World Cup field for the hottest players in the tournament this year. So what I'm going to do is read to you the names in no particular order. And then you guys let us know in the comments, both on YouTube and on Instagram, TikTok, whatever, who you're voting for. Who's your number one? So here's the list. And I don't even know what most of these people look like, by the way. England's Jude Bellingham. Iran's Ehsan Hasjafi. Portugal's Ruben Dias. New Zealand's Marco Stominic. Australia's Matthew Lecky. Belgium's Kevin De Bruyne. Captain America, Christian Pulisic. And then finally, of course, we're just going with Cristiano Ronaldo's abs.
No, we can't do Ronaldo.
Those are some sick abs, sir. That man is 41.
Yeah, they are, but it's yesterday.
That man is 41 years old. Look at those. You know. That's an 8-pack.
Yeah.
You kidding me with that
he
shit?
He can just go back and post videos in Dubai when it was over.
It's so close. Yeah. All right, so that's a great list. Please let us know who we should objectify the most out of this entire group of people. And, you know, we look forward to reading along with you in the comments here, especially on YouTube. Again, this is why you should be a YouTube subscriber, because you get to check all the people out.
Yeah. You get the pictures.
Pod Save the World is brought to you by Helix. We all need a great sleep. It's a critical part of being a human being, resting. Get a good night's sleep. You'll feel better, be in a better mood. You'll learn more, do a better job at work.
Helix is a critical way to improve your sleep. They deliver the perfect mattress right to your door with free shipping in the U.S. How do you know which mattress is right for you? Take the Helix Sleep Quiz and it'll match you with the perfect mattress based on your personal preferences and your sleep needs. They have over 20 mattress models, so you can find the perfect model for you. The Happy with Helix Guarantee offers a free customer-first experience designed to ensure you're completely satisfied with your new mattress so you can rest easy with seamless returns and exchanges. Plus, Helix offers a 120-night sleep trial and limited lifetime warranty. Helix mattresses are great. They are super comfortable. We have one in my house. Every time someone stays on it, they say, hey, that's an unbelievably comfortable mattress. And on top of that, it just shows up at your door. It's super easy. You take the quiz. They figure out what you need. Bada bing, bada boom, you're done. Go to helixsleep.com/world for 20% off site-wide. That's helixsleep.com/world for 20% off site-wide. helixsleep.com/world. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Ridge. I think we've all had that god-awful wallet that was super thick and uncomfortable and bulky and full of business cards. Mm. Never needed, never wanted. Don't know why we had them, but they were just there.
Business cards.
That we call it the pre-Ridge wallet. Most men's wallets are gigantic, crusty leather bricks that can't exist in your back pocket without causing you to sit at a weird angle. You know who probably still has the same crusty, oversized wallet? Your dad. At a certain point, it's not even a wallet anymore. It's a filing cabinet. That's where Ridge Wallet comes in. This Father's Day, get your dad something that he'll enjoy using every single day. Ridge Wallets feature a unique, slim, modern design that holds up to 12 cards plus cash. They're made with premium materials like aluminum, titanium, and carbon fiber, which make them reliable, durable, and guaranteed for life. Ridge was built by a father and a son, designed to meet the same standard dads set every day.
Cats in the cradle and the moon. Keep going, Tommy.
All Ridge products have a lifetime warranty. This is literally the last wallet you'll ever have to buy, a value that even the most skeptical dad could appreciate. For a limited time, Ridge is running their huge Father's Day sale where you can get up to 40% off their best gear. Just head to ridge.com/PSTW and don't miss out on one of their biggest discounts all year. That's ridge.com/PSTW for up to 40% off. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. All right, Ben, back to nerdy stuff. So Chinese President Xi Jinping was on the road this week. So he was in North Korea for the first time in 7 years to meet with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. We don't have a ton of information about what they discussed, obviously, because it's two dictators getting together. But in the run-up to the visit, there were a bunch of fascinating stories. The Times had one, the Wall Street Journal had one, about North Korea's surprising economic turnaround. So the Journal, like, they talked to a bunch of recent visitors to North Korea who had talked about landing, and all of a sudden they're like seeing Chinese electric vehicles all over the place. There's rideshare apps, there's new restaurants, pizza places. There's a general sense of like economic activity happening at a greater level than ever before. They talk about their satellite imagery that shows that North Korea, especially Pyongyang, is three times brighter than it was 5 years ago. Parking lots are full. Oil facilities are more active. You can see that in satellite imagery as well. And the pieces both, you know, they juxtapose this economic recovery with the economic catastrophe that hit North Korea during the pandemic. That was the moment when Kim Jong-un was literally giving a speech, apologizing and weeping to his own people because they couldn't eat. So the biggest driver of this economic change for North Korea, I think, seems to be clearly the increased partnership between North Korea and Russia since the war in Ukraine. A South Korean think tank called INSS said that from late 2023 through 2025, North Korean arms sales to Russia generated more than $10 billion, which is just a huge boost for a country with an estimated $27 billion GDP. But North Korea also benefited from deploying 16,000 soldiers to fight on behalf of the Russians. Reminder that a third of them were hurt or killed. Kim has made billions from state-backed hacking efforts, especially stealing cryptocurrency or extorting places for it. And then they seemingly have just gotten better at evading U.S. sanctions and that have steadily ratcheted up trade with China. So this is clearly a win for Kim Jong-un. And I would say it's just unequivocally a good thing, right? If your average North Korean has more food and has a slightly better life, right? But there's a lot of downsides that I'll just quickly tick through. These reports make it sound like North Korean repression has gotten worse and more pervasive, not better. So Kim Jong-un is not just executing, you know, his uncle, who's a general that he thinks is disloyal. He is reportedly executing people just distributing South Korean TV shows or music. So that is horrible. The economic benefits are obviously primarily going to elites in Pyongyang. Some
you know, some of those quality of life improvements probably trickle down to the city's residents if there's just more general economic activity. But it's not clear if it's leaving Pyongyang at all. Like, there's some development in other cities and some in rural areas, but it's just like, it's way, way less beneficial to people outside of the capital. And the UN still believes that nearly half of the people outside of Pyongyang are malnourished. We don't really know exactly what North Korea is getting from Russia in terms of military support and technology. There's concern that they could get a nuclear-powered submarine and new warships and drones. And then finally, there's just the nuclear arsenal ban. I mean, that's the reason we're at war with Iran. Kim is believed to have at least 50 assembled nuclear warheads, the components to build up to 100 more or nearly 100 more, and then the capacity to produce, you know, maybe a dozen, maybe 20 more per year. And then they have an ICBM that could hit the U.S. So they are a genuine threat to U.S. national security. So Ben, Trump had three meetings with Kim Jong-un in the first term. He failed to accomplish anything through those meetings. Then it seems like he's just decided to forget that the problem exists. I'm curious what you think, though. Like, given what's happening in Iran, I don't know if that's the worst thing, that he's just ignoring the problem rather than waging a war. But what did you make of these reports and Xi's visit?
I think it is a incredible monument to the absolute failure of U.S. sanctions policy. Because we have so over-sanctioned all these countries that they now just ignore our sanctions. You know, I'm old enough to remember when China and Russia actually participated in the sanctions on North Korea. That's something that used to happen. And I'm sure they cheated a little bit around the edges. But I think that what's happened in recent years is, as the United States has sanctioned Russia, as the United States has put more sanctions on China too, they're just like, well, screw this. Like, there's a whole parallel economy that we're going to create where we're trading in different ways and we're bartering things and we're using crypto and, you know, we're just evading the dollar in transactions. And so the fact that North Korea still has all these U.S. sanctions on it and they're just building shit and they've got electric vehicles and they're selling weapons, like, it's a sign that the over-sanctioning of countries has actually created a dynamic where there's so many countries that are over-sanctioned that they just create a parallel trade system with each other.
Yeah, you know? That's really a good point.
I think that the danger is, you know, is twofold. Like, you mentioned the repression. I think some people might think, well, why is the repression getting worse? Well, in part because if things are really, really shitty in the country, you kind of have to be a little cautious about being so repressive because you don't want to create the powder keg that explodes. But if you're riding high and you feel like, you know, you're on the upswing as Kim does right now, well, then yeah, like you're keeping enough people happier that, you know, you can repress the hell out of the people that do things you don't like. The only other thing I'd introduce, Tommy, is that I don't trust Kim Jong-un's temperament.
No.
Not that we know that much about it. I mean, we know that he, like, you know, like, attacked Sony because of that movie with James Franco, right? I worry that if he's feeling more and more emboldened and he's got this nuclear arsenal as a deterrent and he's got Russia giving him advanced technology and he's got, you know, some money from these various things, that he might just start messing around with South Korea, you know, and maybe not a full-scale invasion, but, like, we're going to seize some islands or we're going to sink a boat, you know, and what are you going to do about it? We have nuclear weapons. And so I think it is, I'd prefer Trump ignore it because Trump's two approaches seem to be either launching a war or, like, bear hugging someone and announcing it's historic, even though nothing is accomplished, as he did with Kim. But there's a non-zero chance that this thing, you know, presents itself as a threat through some kind of provocation to South Korea.
Yeah, there could trade, you know, there was a recent incident where, like, you know, North Koreans and South Koreans traded fire on these small islands, and all of a sudden, you know,
yeah,
you could be off to, yeah, the races in some war. Highly recommend both these pieces. Just sort of a fascinating look.
Yeah, they're
at
very
a country
good.
Country where,
yeah,
you know, I haven't talked about them in a while. Real quick, Ben, we talked a while back about how former Trump National Security Advisor and full-time warmonger John Bolton was being prosecuted for illegally retaining classified information and then using it to help write his book. Last week, CNN reported that Bolton is going to plead guilty to unlawfully holding onto classified information and pay a $2.25 million fine. Apparently, he could still face up to 5 years in prison, assuming the deal is approved. But so the next court hearing is, like, June 26th. Initially, Bolton had pleaded not guilty on 18 counts, but more reports kept coming out. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh, boy, this guy is in deep shit. The one count he's reportedly pleading guilty to is writing down classified stuff in his diary and sharing that information with his wife and daughter via his own personal email and some like messaging app, which was just insanely stupid. Like, I literally can't believe he did this. The whole case might have come to light because Iran hacked Bolton's email in 2021, and I think the U.S. figured it out. So, you know, no word on whether Trump will also have to plead guilty for having classified records next to the shitter at Mar-a-Lago, but it does seem like there might be a resolution soon for Mr. Bolton.
Well, we said, you know, when this first kind of emerged, these details, including sending emails to his wife and daughter about classified information, let's not please put this in the category of the vindictive political persecutions, you know, the James Comey with the, you know, sand on the beach or whatever it was, or Tish James. Like, this is like, there's an underlying crime here. Now, it is pretty selectively enforced, but this was a pretty brazen violation.
It's crazy.
So it feels like, I'm not sure the guy needs, and I'm no fan of John Bolton, I'm not sure he has to do hard time. I mean, a couple million bucks is not nothing, but yeah, man, like, you know, I mean, I guess the hypocrisy is, you know, Trump is giving himself a different set of rules. And yeah. And actually what I wonder, Tommy, is to take it to today, do you really trust that like Steve Witkoff or guys like that aren't like walking around with classified information?
Oh, no.
I don't know anything. I'm not alleged, you know, but it feels like they're probably pretty casual about their use of personal email.
No doubt.
And what they do with, you know, these people, Kushner and Witkoff, like, did they even work for the U.S.
Kushner
government?
Doesn't have a job. Witkoff definitely does.
Kushner, he doesn't have a job.
Yeah.
Kushner clearly has classified information, though. Like, under what basis? You know, like, so I like it is pretty selective, even if, you know, clearly there was a crime here.
Yeah. Longtime listeners to this show know that we find stories about corruption and gold bars irresistible. Shout out to our guy, Bob Menendez. But now there's a new entrant into this kind of canon, Ben. After investigators found 303 gold bars in the home of a CIA official named David Rush, they also found $2 million in cash and 36 luxury watches. So this guy, the gold alone was worth more than $40 billion. The Washington Post reported that this guy created a fake, highly classified intelligence program that he used to funnel money to himself. And he might have read in, it was so secretive that he read people into it, apparently a couple of them, but those people couldn't talk to anyone else about it because it was a special action program. So he might have made them unwitting accomplices. It's not really clear yet. We don't have a ton of details due to the classification issues. We know that Rush worked in the Directorate of Science and Technology at the CIA. Those are the people that make all the cool like spying tools, all the gadgets, all the actual tech.
Yeah.
Very important component. One source told the Post that the fake program was about continuity of government operations. So like what the government does if we're nuked by something, and that's how we got the gold bars. I don't know. There was also some like kind of vague part of the Post story about how Rush was also involved in some of the CIA's most sensitive collection programs. And that sort of shocked people that he could be both doing that and this corruption stuff. I don't know. Who knows? It's impossible to read between the lines sometimes with these. So Ben, I obviously don't support stealing taxpayer dollars, but I do kind of respect the hustle here. Like creating a-
Respect the game, yeah.
Creating a special access program that's so secretive that it's like known only to you and convincing the US government to give you gold bars, like that's impressive work.
I mean, at least we know we have like capable spies. I read this and like two concerns hit me, right? So the first is that there's long been talk, and I've talked to people in intelligence, that the growth of these private intelligence firms, you know, like the Wagner Group for Russia, Blackwater and all of its offshoots in the US, has kind of created this dynamic where, like, if you're like a really good CIA operative, you also know that, well, shit, if I reach a point in my career, I can just leave and make 10X,
right,
you know,
right,
working for these guys. And that might bleed into like, well, I deserve to make a little bit on the side, you know, like, and that leads me to the second point, which is, you know, not dissimilar than what I was just saying about classified information. When your government is run by a grifter who is using the government to enrich himself and his family.
He's like day trading.
As we just talked about with Jared and Ivanka, and insider trading probably people around Trump off of like things like the war in Iran. And that person has removed any values proposition from your government service, is probably like being casual about, you know, your relationships that you built in foreign countries, right? Because we're insulting those countries or we're picking fights with those leaders. you know, grift begets grift. And I, you know, there's been a lot of talk about whether the, you know, there's incompetence or MAGA people embedded in places like the intelligence community. That's a concern. I think another concern is just like, are these guys looking around and being like, well, shit, like this whole government is now just a grift. I might as well have my gold bars won.
It's amazing. This guy, what a guy. Also, bad. My concern was like a vetting of these people. Like, apparently this guy claimed to have a degree from Clemson in RPI. The FBI then found no record of him attending either school. He claimed to have been a Navy pilot. There's no evidence of that either. They also alleged that Rush lied to the CIA about all of this and fraudulently got like $77,000 in military leave pay, despite being discharged from the Navy as far back as 2015. So like this guy was just clearly lying about so much stuff and no one caught it until he had assembled 300 plus gold bars in his home. It feels like we got to be catching these people a little earlier, or else there's a lot of other things happening that is pretty damaging to national security that we're just missing.
Yeah, well, the colonoscopy that they put us through to get security clearances kind of manages to put a giant spotlight on like your college marijuana use as disqualifying from government service. But somehow couldn't figure out this guy didn't go to school. Time to overhaul that whole system, right? Yeah. Of how we clear people, to let more people through who deserve it and to winnow out the people that are lying about it. At least this guy, if he crashes and burns, if he has some time in prison, he could probably write a pretty good Netflix show while he's there.
Yeah, I'd love to know about this special access program. Finally, Ben, speaking of unbelievably ballsy cons, I want to tell you briefly about someone named Mahmoud Sadiz Buba. So Buba was a candidate for Nigeria's House of Representatives. There was a video that got released by his political party. They're kind of like asking him questions about his candidacy, and it exploded on social media because he did not look or sound like a traditional politician. So as the Nigerian paper, The Whistler, put it, quote, "His physical appearance, specifically his small stature due to dwarfism and his remarkably youthful face, triggered an immediate wave of public reaction." So a lot of this reaction was inspired by the fact that, you know, this guy, he wasn't rich, he wasn't famous, he was dealing with dwarfism, but he was able to run for office, right? A lot of people found that exciting and inspirational. But the story quickly fell apart when documents surfaced that listed Buba's actual age. This guy had been telling people he was 30 years old. It turns out he is only 15 years old, and he somehow managed to fool everybody about his age, despite a lot of visual evidence to the contrary that might lead you to believe, like, actually, this person seems like they are a child. Check out this video compilation of Buba meeting with voters and talking with the media.
How old are you? How old are you? Huh? 30 years? Really? Wow. You're 30 years? You're only allowed to answer with one word.
Yeah.
So, criticism. What do you think criticism is? Fuel or distraction?
Distraction.
So, do you think social media, is it a blessing or pressure?
Pressure. Okay. Some pressure.
One word.
Some blessing.
One word.
This is blessing.
Okay. So, one word for your supporters.
Encourage them. Come and vote quietly. No fight. No something like that.
So, confidence. Is it learned or is it natural?
Natural.
So, Ben, I love this kid because it takes balls to run for office no matter what. It takes even bigger balls to run for office and lie about your age because you're only 15 years old. It takes balls of steel to fake your age and run for office while having a genetic condition that makes you look like a literal five-year-old and then still let them film you riding on a miniature red pony. That part of the thing nearly killed me. I want to make this kid president immediately. Just put him in there, install him.
Remember we had kid president in the Iran years?
Yes, I love that
kid. This guy should be kid president, man. We finally arrived at the stage of the podcast where I like the grift.
You know,
this is not Jared and Ivanka building a resort. This is not the gold bars. Like, this is a guy having a pretty good time. And look, I mean, Nigeria, man, like, that. I'm old enough to have gotten the, you know, those emails from the fake Nigerian princes, you know. There's some entrepreneurial spirit there. that I respect, you know.
Man, yeah, Mahmoud. Mahmoud Sadis Bouba, we respect you. Keep up the great
work.
We
respect you.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, you're going to hear my interview with the BBC's Will Grant about what life is like on the ground in Cuba, concerns about Trump staging some sort of Venezuela-like operation, and much, much more. So stick around for that. Pod Save the World is brought to you by Simply Safe. The problem with most home security systems, they only alert you after a break-in has already begun, and that is too late. That's why you need Simply Safe to secure your home. Using the Outdoor Camera Series 2 and advanced AI alerts, Simply Safe's US-based live agents identify threats on your property and help deter them, stopping crime before it starts. Simply Safe's home security systems are designed and easy to get set up on your own. No drilling required, no waiting around for a technician to show up. The app-guided installation walks you through the process so you can get your system armed in less than an hour. And best of all, Simply Safe is actually affordable. Monitoring plans start affordably at around $1 a day. No long-term contracts or cancellation fees. I'm sitting across from a man who set up a Simply Safe system all by himself. What stood out to you?
Boy, so easy. You customize it, then it comes in the mail. You set it up in a matter of minutes. There's no, you don't need to use a drill. You can just stick it up there and then it works. And the app is great. And the customer support is great. And you got peace of mind.
You heard it here first, folks. We want you to experience the peace of mind of real home security, which is why we've partnered with Simply Safe to offer an exclusive discount to Pod Save the World listeners. Right now, you can get 50% off your new system by visiting simplysafe.com/crookedworld. That's half off at simplysafe.com/crookedworld. There's no safe like Simply Safe. My guest today is the Mexico, Central America, and Cuba correspondent for the BBC and recently got back from a trip to Cuba. Will Grant, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's terrific to be with you.
Thank you for doing this. So you have spent a bunch of time in Cuba, both recently and then over many years. How has life changed for Cuban people since President Trump sort of drastically ratcheted up sanctions?
Well, I lived there for 7 years, starting sort of towards the end of 2014. So I saw this sort of narrative arc in Cuba of the Obama administration's policy of opening, the sort of optimism that was going with that among ordinary people who really did feel like the Cold War might truly be behind them. It felt like a period of opportunity for young people. There was quite a lot of dynamism, a sense there might be a future for a lot of young people on the island. And that was a positive experience to see that whole period, to live there during that. Comparing that to today, it feels very far removed. You have had, of course, a series of steps taken both under the first Trump presidency and then continued by the Biden presidency, which were, if you like, the unpicking of that policy of engagement, and putting it back very much on a hostile footing. So that started long before where we are today and was continued under the Biden administration. Where we are today is after the removal of Nicolas Maduro from power on the 3rd of January, basically the switching off of the tap of oil, of crude oil to Cuba from Venezuela. And not just from Cuba. The Trump administration has made it abundantly clear to Mexico that it expects not a drop of oil to arrive from Mexico either, or anywhere else in the world for that matter. We've only seen really one shipment make it through of 830,000 barrels from Russia. But other than that, it is Cuba's only producing what it produces, which is nowhere near enough for domestic consumption, and surviving in any which way it can. Huge restrictions on consumption. So you're seeing no cars on the streets. You're seeing these long and very arduous blackouts. You're seeing hospitals running at a fraction of their capacity. You're seeing schools shuttered on many days of the week. Normal businesses simply aren't operating. State businesses are closed. People are having to walk everywhere or cycle. And you know, that's some of it. The worst bit is that the summer is coming. The summer months are very hot. The mosquitoes, there's no, you know, power with which to run air conditioning or fans to keep the mosquitoes at bay. You're seeing no trash picked up from the streets. The garbage trucks aren't doing their rounds, the state-run fleet of garbage trucks. So you put all of these things into the single experience and it is incredibly bleak. It really is very, very dire and actively getting worse week after week after week.
Yeah, I mean, those dire conditions you talk about, I mean, no refrigeration for food, no transportation for, you know, trash pickup or anything else. Hospitals just having to shut off, I guess, because they don't have power. I mean, if you can't keep the lights on, I don't know how you perform a surgery or do anything else. Have those factors resulted in any measurable impact on mortality or health outcomes that you've seen? Can we measure that?
You can't get reliable statistics on these things. You're completely, you know, beholden to the Cuban state in terms of what it says is and isn't happening. But we know, I mean, I know anecdotally from going to a hospital during blackouts that they are only accepting, in many cases, emergency cases. I don't know to what extent we can give, you know, anyone's got the number yet about, you know, how many more, you know, how this is hitting infant mortality or impacting pregnancies or, you know, the death rate among curable disease and things like this. But if it's not there yet, it's certainly in the post. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the feeling among ordinary Cubans. The hospitals are doing what they can. And I saw inside, for example, a maternity ward that does have a very large generator and is running, you know, for the very, very basics. I've been in contact throughout this experience with a pregnant woman who's now just had her baby. It was a pretty bleak and difficult experience, but the baby was born. The attention to her from the medical staff was good. But it is sort of down to the individuals and their hard work, really, to make sure she was looked after in these very, very trying circumstances.
Jesus, I just can't even imagine having to give birth in that circumstance. It's unimaginable. I know there have been some big protests of the economic conditions. What is your sense of whether the Cuban people, generally speaking, blame the government for this crisis or the Trump administration policies?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question because it really is a division. Now, you would expect there'd be outright anger just at the Trump administration for what it's doing. You know, that this has been imposed upon the island from outside. But there is a lot of anger at the Cuban government for the fact that these things predate not just Trump's current policy, but even Trump returning to power, you know, coming back to office for his second term, that the island was already going through blackouts, that the island didn't make the most of a sort of its economic opportunities, that there is mismanagement of the economy, that they have been building 5-star hotels instead of investing in electricity infrastructure, power infrastructure, things like this. So that anger at the sort of Cuban state's decision making is very, very present. Let's make no mistake about that. And what's interesting is that although there is plenty of people on the streets when the government organizes a protest outside the US embassy, and they will echo the slogans, and there is genuine anger, of course, at the Trump administration, I've also seen people lose their fear. Now, as a journalist who's worked there a lot, you know, I used to put the microphones in front of people and they just repeat these lines out of Granma, the state-run newspaper, or, you know, the revolutionary slogans. You couldn't get any kind of feeling for what people actually wanted to say, or it was very difficult to get that on tape. It was very couched and careful. Not anymore. People are just saying whatever they want, or a lot of people are. And I've heard some people say as brazenly as, I hope Trump does come in and take this over. I'm done. You know, whatever's coming, let it come. We need change. So that has been one of the surprises to me, that it's not sort of coalesced into this cold, hard anger at Marco Rubio and at Donald Trump as much as one might imagine. That is there. Of course it's there, particularly among the revolutionaries, where it's very, very present. But among a lot of ordinary people, they just want whatever this is to be over so that they can have some semblance of a normal life, some semblance of a normal relationship with Washington, some kind of existence that's dignified for their children. They can send their children to school without empty bellies. I mean, we're talking basic stuff. This is sort of survival mode at the moment, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the answer is probably it's complicated, but, you know, there's been a bunch of reporting about the strength of Cuban nationalism and the likelihood that Cubans in general would resist sort of a quote-unquote Venezuela option where the U.S. comes in, removes, say, the Castros or Raul Castro, and, you know, leaves in a more pliant government that they feel like they can control. But it sounds like what you're saying is you have heard from some Cubans that maybe they look at Venezuela and think, I don't know, that seems preferable to whatever this is.
Yeah, I've sort of heard both ends of the scale. This, let's not forget that the Cuban Revolution was really a nationalist movement before it was a Marxist-Leninist one. You know, it's very much about kind of la patria, you know, about the island and the island's independence. And that's what Fidel Castro gave to the people in 1959 after being basically run by not just the Washington Craven dictatorship at the time, but a series of them really throughout the 20th century to that point. So that's really its first manifestation. And then it's sort of, you know, he sort of or either fell into the arms or was pushed, you know, it's a debate in Latin American academic circles, into the arms of the Soviet Union, into the arms of Moscow. The truth of the matter is it became, obviously, as we know, this communist revolution in a bipolar world, and it doesn't really seem to have a handle on what it is for the 21st century. And that's, again, not right now and Donald Trump or even the Obama administration's attempts to sort of pick a route through all this. I think it's been a little bit lost, really, for a while in terms of offering a sort of viable alternative to Cuban's young people who have opted for exodus, who have opted for migration instead. But you're absolutely right. The look at the Venezuelan model, I think, brings these two things. One is the sort of old school revolutionaries. And I spoke to one who was sort of by the side of Che Guevara on the battlefield, who's saying, you know, we're not Venezuela. We'll be fighting until our last breath. You know, just give me in my 80s a rifle, that kind of attitude. And those others who are saying, we need change. And if that change needs to be radical, if it needs to be stripping the Band-Aid off in one, then we've got to do that. You know, that we can't continue along this path because it's leaving far too many hungry people. It's leaving pensioners without any kind of dignified pension that's reflected in any way with the prices on the supermarket shelves.
There have also been reports of, you know, I think talks between the Trump administration and maybe, you know, Castro's grandson or nephew. And then CIA Director John Ratcliffe was in Cuba recently. It's not entirely clear what his message was. I mean, they put out a press release claiming what it was, but, you know, it sounded to me like a bit of an opportunity to deliver an ultimatum. In that moment, I felt like the lights were kind of blinking red, that something was about to happen in terms of the Trump administration, like taking a next step to pressure the Cubans. That obviously has not. But is there any reporting on or sense of what these conversations have been about?
I almost want to take a beat and go, you know, that's the CIA director was in Havana, you know. It's
right.
just so extraordinary. And I was standing on the Malecón just in the very days after, which is the waterfront promenade in Havana that runs all the way the length of the city, you know, the long part of the city. And I was standing there during a protest, a government organized protest outside the US embassy when John Ratcliffe went to Venezuela. So this was straight in the days after the Venezuela operation and Maduro now in custody. And John Ratcliffe was in Venezuela. And I showed this to a Cuban official and I literally saw him sort of turn gray, you know.
Wow.
It just extraordinary stuff, Tommy. Like, I've been doing this a long time now. You know, I've basically dedicated my career to Latin American coverage. And it's still, I can't quite believe there's been military action in Venezuela in the 21st century. I can't believe
Same.
That, you know, that there's been these, all of these things have happened to lead to the point that you have the CIA director sitting down in front of Raul Castro's grandson, the interior minister and the head of the intelligence services of Cuba. Exactly as you say, exactly what was that conversation? What was said? What was the message delivery? Was it merely in part the message delivery is the presence, being there of sort of, you know, showing that moment that we're here and we're very, very serious. Now, let's remember it happened fractionally before the indictment against Raul Castro.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have been saying, look, this is in the pipeline, right. It's coming, and we are 100% serious about the fact that we expect root and branch change to the Cuban Revolution. We don't expect a tinkering at the top and a little moving around here and a bit more economic openness, which arguably would be the suggestion that that's all that the Obama administration was able to achieve. You know, that's the Miami view of mm-hmm. what was sort of the failures, if you like, of the yep. Rapprochement, that it didn't go far enough. It didn't really achieve meaningful change. That Marco Rubio isn't going to be convinced by those things, that he wants nothing less than wholesale economic and political change to the Cuban Revolution. So I assume some version of that was the message that was brought with by John Radcliffe. We'll have to see exactly what the response of the Cuban government will be. Again, I would agree with you. I think it looked at that point like it really was on the cusp of something happening. And now there seems to have been this delay. President Trump has made it clear that it will always be after Iran, and Iran can't be said to be over at this stage, you know, in those terms. So could it be as simple as well as the World Cup having some kind of influence where, you know, would you really be carrying out military action of some description on an island that's 90 miles off the coast of Florida, closing the airspace to Miami where there are matches and so on, you know? So who knows exactly what the calculations are, but I do think at the heart of the calculation is something will happen unless what Havana puts on the table is deemed good enough to Washington.
Yeah, this is a really good point about the World Cup. I guess time will tell. Trump certainly seems to have kind of a project underway of trying to prop up as many right-wing governments in Latin America as he can. There's clearly this pressure campaign on the Cubans following on the Maduro operation. The human cost is enormous. There's a lot of conversation about the Venezuela option for Cuba. What on earth could or would that look like, do you think?
I think that is also the question that so many ordinary Cubans are asking themselves. Exactly what is it? You know, it is coming, but what is it? And I think that is the one thing that none of us know at this stage. It could be the Venezuela option of some kind of swooping in. Would they do that to a 95-year-old, original founder of the revolution? Because that really would get ordinary Cubans' backs up, I think, even those who want to see change. Almost in the sense that you don't do that to an old right. man. Like, you know, he's lived his life, and that, you know, that wouldn't go along with Cuban society, I don't think, at all well. At the same time, maybe it is some kind of tactical military action similar to what was seen in Venezuela, but not against him if he is simply removed from the equation, and it's against other members of the top leadership. Is it nothing to do with actually striking or seeing boots on the ground on the Malecón, which would be the most extraordinary idea? But this is, I think, the rub, is that all of these things would have felt so outlandish. And I'm not talking outlandish, you know, 5 years ago when they would have seemed incredibly unlikely. But, you know, 7 months ago, mm-hmm. it seemed completely impossible that you'd be having this conversation about Cuba. But because of what we've seen in Venezuela, there is the point of example. And I think that is what the Trump administration is using as the ace up its sleeve. It's, look, we are capable of doing this. And let's not forget that when the military action in Venezuela was carried out, more than 30 of those who were killed, I think it's 34, were Cubans.
Yeah.
They were the Cuban soldiers and close security officers around Nicolas Maduro. And the Delta Force cut through them in seconds with these extremely sophisticated weapons, extremely well-planned operation. And that, again, is back to that messaging that John Radcliffe may have been bringing with him, which basically says, you are simply no match for us. Your revolutionary fervor might have been relevant in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. You may have, you know, under Fidel, sort of won certain moments against us. This is now, in the 21st century, where nothing that you have can compare to what we have militarily. So I think the vastly safest option for the ordinary Cubans, and therefore potentially for the Cuban government, if it's capable of taking that path, would be the negotiated solution, which will have to mean, as we've mentioned, this complete redrawing of the sort of political and economic map, basically letting go of the reins of tourism infrastructure, tourism real estate, letting go of the reins of the import-export businesses, somehow reimagining the island's politics and economy.
They should check out the Bay of Pigs. I heard it's a good strategic location to land troops and then conduct an operation. Obviously, just kidding here.
No comment.
But I wanted to talk to you about the World Cup because you're in Mexico City right now. In the U.S., there's a lot of excitement. Like, I can't wait to watch the games. I can't believe there's going to be like four games a day for weeks. It's madness. Yeah. But some of that excitement is tempered by crazy ticket prices, anxieties about ICE, anxieties about, you know, visas and players getting in, general dislike of Trump. What's the vibe like in Mexico right now in advance of the games?
You know, I've been saying, I think if this were the Mexico 2026 World Cup, this place would be humming by now. You know, you'd have all of the different teams here. You'd have kind of, you know, events from all of the different teams around their camps. There'd be this sort of buoyance. But unfortunately, it isn't like that yet. Now, there's not long to go until kickoff. But, you know, I think that people are looking at some of the hassles and the obstacles to this point more than they are the football so far. So specifically, there's been difficulties at the airport, rebuilding the airport from, you know, a sort of non-functional parts of it, whether or not that's, you know, queues to get your luggage or taxis and things. It's just a very, very hassly experience to get in and out of Mexico City's main airport. So they've done this major multi-million dollar refurbishment, but it's going on and it's, you know, it's really not got very much time left and there are still hassles there. Traffic in Mexico, as we know, there are major protests planned by the teachers union, by transport workers, by the families of the disappeared. There's 130,000 disappeared people in Mexico and their families are really using this World Cup to say, look, you're doing all this security around this event. Where's the security when it comes to finding our missing loved ones, to bringing those who are believed to still be alive and forced into working for the cartels home and, you know, dealing with this issue that we've been calling for years and years and years. And of course, it was only February when we saw cartel members on the streets setting fire to vehicles, setting fire to stores, convenience stores, right, spreading fear and violence in 20 of the 32 states. I don't think that that side of it will impact incoming fans. I mean, it's simply not particularly good for business from a cartel point of view to do something like that to, you know, to fans coming in to watch football games. I don't think that will be in their mindset at all. But nevertheless, it was a serious security concern. It must be a worry for those who do have tickets in their hand going, how will that work out? I went to Monterrey, which is one of the host cities, and was shown all the security measures they're doing there by the police and by the security forces. It's a pretty major operation, and they're more focused on the natural things that go with big soccer matches, big sporting events like crowd control and petty theft and small, you know, episodes of violence, rather than cartels. They're convinced that the cartels won't be an issue. All of this back to your original question, how are people feeling? You know, is there anticipation and excitement? There's some, and the more we get closer, I think the greater the excitement. The hassle is that there is just too many things going on. This is a shared World Cup with the Trump administration in charge in the US at a time when relations are far from great. It's this three countries, the sort of NAFTA World Cup.
Right.
And it's just not necessarily got the same ability to coalesce kind of one nation around one idea, which is, hey, we're doing this. We're going to put on the great show where it's Mexico in the eyes of the world. You know, it's, well, we've got less than a third of the games.
Right.
But still, Mexicans are fantastic hosts. They want this to go well. They want to show their best side. They want this to be, you know, best foot forward. And they want, I think, to show that they can overcome these challenges, particularly President Claudia Sheinbaum. She has been a consistent voice saying, this is going to be fine. Not only fine, it's going to be great. We're going to do really well. Mexico will be the bit that everybody remembers. You know, this is going to be a great World Cup. But push is coming to shove on that right now.
Yeah, clock is ticking. I guess, you know, first game is Thursday, I think. It's good to hear that the concerns about cartel violence have lessened. I mean, I was talking to someone, a friend yesterday, kind of in the soccer media world, who was telling me about some of those anxieties. I remember, you know, there was some thinking that maybe the cartels could react to government operations against, you know, their leadership at the games. I agree with you, though. I mean, it seems like boy, that's a great way to have Donald Trump suddenly, you know, launching drone strikes on your operations, wherever they may be. It's also kind of heartening to know that the U.S. isn't the only country where we inject politics into our sports and try to make it, you know, complicated, for lack of a better term. One way it's complicated, by the way, is the U.S. is forcing the Iranian team to stay in Mexico and fly back and forth to the U.S. for games. Is the Iranian team out and about doing stuff at all? And is there any awareness or reaction to that kind of general dickishness from the U.S. Among Mexicans?
I think they're very, very aware that they are hosting the Iranian team around this World Cup and that they're up there in Tijuana, right on the border, so that they can at least get reasonably quickly to the games in Los Angeles. But it's obviously a much bigger trip up to their one game in Seattle and then back. And then obviously if they make it out of the group stages, then there are more logistical hassles beyond that. Claudia Sheinbaum, again, was very kind of forthright about this, going, look, FIFA's come to me and they've asked me to do this. America is, you know, got its own question going on there. I don't agree with it. We have absolutely no problem in having the Iranians here. And she was pretty proud of that one, I think, to make sure that it was that thing that I mentioned, that hosting, that good host, that, you know, that welcoming side of the Mexican society. So yes, there was quite a lot of coverage of their arrival up since then. Essentially, like all teams, they pretty much keep a low profile. They're training. You're only allowed to see a few minutes of them train if you're a journalist accredited for that sort of stuff anyway. And I know a lot of journalists have gone up to Tijuana to see them. But I think they're trying probably now to focus on the actual sport rather than the politics. It must have been quite, an exhausting experience to get to this point. I mean, their flight alone, I think, was Istanbul, Madrid, you know, Tijuana. It's a long way round, considering they're meant to be in Arizona. But yeah, Mexicans are well aware of that side story to the whole, this drama, if you like.
What a mess. Just let the guys in, let them play. Well, at least they aren't doing that dumb gambit. We were trying to force the Italians in and kick the Iranians out at one point. I'm like, come on. I don't think even the Italians were like, this is stupid. This is embarrassing for us. Will Grant, thank you for joining the show. I've been a huge fan of your work on the BBC for a very long time. So it's great to finally get to talk with you and hopefully get to go to a game.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm accredited and I'm hoping to see inside the Azteca for that kickoff. That'll be a fun one. A bit split in my house. If England win their group stage and then their first match and Mexico do the knockout match and Mexico do the same, then it could be England, Mexico in the Azteca, which would be chef's kiss. But my kids are Mexican, so this house will be a tricky one.
I was going to say, a house divided will not stand. But we'll hopefully we get there. That'd be a hell of a good match.
Yeah,
anyway, thank you, Will. Appreciate your time.
Genuine pleasure.
Thanks again to Will Grant for joining the show, and thanks to you guys for listening, and talk to you guys next week. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Alona Minkowski, Michael Goldsmith, and Anisha Banerjee. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Ben Heathcote, Jordan Cantor, Kenny Moffitt, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.